Welcome to part 5 of the PDH course for the National Fire Protection Association Fire Alarm Code. That's NFPA 72. We're doing the 2007 edition, actually based upon the handbook of the Fire Alarm Code. I think I mentioned that previously, but the code is the code, the handbook is the handbook, and this course is something else entirely. Battery sizing and voltage drop calculations. The code requires that battery selection, wire size selection, and count of devices per circuit be documented with the permit application. The engineering consultant can do this if a single supplier has been selected and the consultant is intimately familiar with the components. Usually, however, a generic specification is issued and the successful bidder does the calculations and submits them with the permit application. Vendors have validated spreadsheets and custom software for the calculations. A reasonable question, however, arises at this point. Are you sure the spreadsheet does not contain bad formulas and constants? This comes up right after you read an article on how bad many spreadsheets are. There's no provision in the code to validate the computations, but an experienced plans reviewer will perform a reasonableness test. He's looked at an awful lot of these submissions, and he knows what the right answers are, and he can tell if something's out of line. Now, he probably can't tell if it's 26 instead of 25, but I'm pretty sure he'll recognize 30 instead of 25. While we're questioning modern technology, we might also ask, has the software driving this new fire alarm control unit been validated? Again, the code does not directly address this question, but it does distinguish between operating system software and site software. System software is considered to be the responsibility of the manufacturer. Site software is considered to be the responsibility of the installer. A copy of the site software must be provided to the owner, but phone calls to installers suggest that this is honored in preach more than in compliance. Now, as I think in what I wrote here, I may not be communicating well. The system software is provided by the hardware. That means that it's part of the system that's tested at UL. And these things are rigorously tested. It isn't just it goes by an old guy and he rubber stamps it. They run it through physical tests in the laboratory and have the tests certified that they were run properly and they comply with the requirements of the test. So the fire alarm control unit has been extensively tested by the manufacturer before it's shipped. That means that the software, the system software, has been validated, and a particular set of site software associated with the tests. Now, you change the site software when you get to the project we're building. This, again, is tested, and this is part of the fire alarm code, and I'm told that many municipalities follow this very rigorously, too. They test essentially every component of the fire alarm system as it's installed to make sure that the site software is working properly. Now, how good is this overall? How good is this in the less sophisticated jurisdictions? Can't answer that. I worry about it. I worry about software. One of the reasons is there's been a controversy, and again, it's going on for 20 or 30 years, about the software that operates chemical plants. Because a mistake in the software not only can cause a problem, but more likely it can respond badly to a problem which occurs. And what you want to do is have the software help you identify the problem and help you mitigate the effects of the problem, not have the software make it worse. So what do you do in a chemical plant? Well, one of the proposals has been to license the software programmers that do it. But for whatever reason, the people in charge think that doesn't provide you any benefit at all. I can't help but think maybe that's a result of the professional engineering experience. Do we get better bridges because bridge designers are licensed? Yeah, but in the current news I'm reading as I'm writing this car, we just had a big bridge fall into the Mississippi. Well, the certificate itself, the license itself, doesn't by itself assure good software. And hopefully, when we're talking about operating a chemical plant, the owner of the chemical plant, the people who sell the software, the Allen Bradleys of the world, the Wonderware of the world, have some method of qualifying good programmers from bad programmers. But what I know, just between you and me, about human beings is they are prone to error. There will be defects in the software. As you get tens of thousands of lines of code, there are defects, or there are conditions that simply weren't anticipated that occur, and the software doesn't do the right thing in response to it. But I've answered this as best I could for the firearm situation. It's tested by UL. It's well tested. It's tested in many municipalities, perhaps not all municipalities, for the quality of the sight software. And I would hope that the factory people limit the sight software to the things that are essential and almost bulletproof. Identifying which model number of smoke detector you have shouldn't cause the system to malfunction if you enter wrong code. It should be validated against available smoke detectors. And similarly, you shouldn't have choices that will get you in trouble if the system software has been designed properly. Authority having jurisdiction. A firearm system is purchased by the building owner so that he can get an occupancy permit and move in. The enforcement comes from a building standards department and a building inspector. The approval may come from a city official, a county official, a state official, or a military-based commanding officer. Until recently, factories interpreted the plant manager to be the person in charge. Gas, electric, and communications utilities thought they had independent authority also. Today, there is almost always a building official, this is capital B, capital O, person with a license and an appointment to this title, who issues the occupancy permit. This person and his staff are the authority having jurisdiction, abbreviated AHJ. In a locality, there is only one authority having jurisdiction for firearms. There are exceptions, but they're disappearing. Find your local authority having jurisdiction by asking a firearm vendor or electrical contractor. The significance of the AHJ is that traditionally this person can demand changes to meet his personal preferences. Interpretations of the published code adopted by the locality can be appealed, but construction is delayed during the appeal and the move-in date is delayed and an important agency is alienated. Hardwired and addressable systems and zones. The concept of hardwired zones and addressable systems were discussed in the specification commentary above. Two additional concepts must be presented. First, zones still have meaning. Fire suppression systems and sprinklers are inherently hard piped. When a sprinkler tripped, water flows through a monitored valve supplying a moderately large number of sprinkler heads. The valve only knows that something serious has happened in the area associated with the piping. It is a zone. The monitored valve reports to the firearm control panel that the zone is in alarm. Yes, the valve switch has an address and the panel knows exactly which valve is reporting, but it does not know which sprinkler head's operating. For the fire alarm control unit to report the sprinkler alarm, it must use zones. Similarly, it's easy to program the computer in the fire alarm panel to group detectors into zones. It can report zones to the LED annunciator as required by the state specification we looked at above. Pull stations, enclosures, and key-operated pull stations, required pull station locations. The concept behind pull stations is for residents who are fleeing the fire to notify other residents of the need for evacuation. The first requirement is for pull stations at each exit with very, very few exceptions. Owners and architects often try to avoid extra pull stations. For instance, the commissioner has a private outside entrance to his office. The owner will claim that it is not a public exit and does not need a pull station. The designer, however, may note that secretaries in the outer office may be blocked by the fire from any exit except through the commissioner's office. The private entrance has become the main path of egress and certainly should have a pull station to notify the rest of the staff. A very important topic associated with pull stations is false alarms. Schools now almost universally use clear plastic covers over pull stations. The covers have local battery-operated sounders. Someone who pulls the alarm will set off the sounder, and anyone nearby will know exactly where it came from and notice who is running away. A first reaction on covers to pull stations might be that they interfere with timely alarm and evacuation. This is not the attitude of most fire protection professionals. Avoiding false alarms improves occupant confidence and compliance with evacuation signals. Another variation of pull stations is double action. A double action pull requires two conscious efforts to initiate the alarm, as pull down, then out. It was thought earlier that false alarms resulted from inadvertent operation of the pull station. Double action pulls are still installed, but not emphasized very widely. Another solution to false alarms is to just remove the pull stations. In very difficult situations, such as public housing, the authority having jurisdiction may authorize removing pull stations from the exits. If the exit is continuously monitored by security personnel and the rest of the fire alarm system is in full working order, the reasoning is that the guard is paid to watch for people running out the door and will be in a position to request an investigation. The guard must have an ability to initiate evacuation in this case. Key-operated pull stations are almost the same thing. The pull station remains, but can only be operated by personnel who have a key. The course author strongly recommends an extra pull station at each exit of a high fire hazard location, such as kitchens and boiler rooms. You might ask the question, how does the kitchen local suppression system interact with the building fire alarm system? Actually, this comes up more often in large computer rooms with underfloor and people space discharge of the inert gas. The answer is only slightly. The building fire alarm system must install detectors and notifications in the computer room exactly the same as in the rest of the building. A local suppression system does not replace the building system. The local suppression system must be installed according to a different set of NFPA documents, but in precise compliance. The suppression system must tell the building system that it has an alarm or a trouble condition. The building system does not have to tell the local suppression system anything. A more troublesome aspect is the computer HVAC. NFPA 72 says we have to shut down the fan and close any fire or smoke dampers. The suppression standards require the same thing. On the other hand, the IT people don't want to shut down the fans and restart the computer. So what do we do? Well, in the real world, the building fire alarm gets billed according to the plans, with wire for shutting down the fans left near the fan starter. The local suppression system gets billed according to the plans, with wire for shutting down the fans left near the fan starter. Only a diligent electrical inspector or fire marshal will get any of the wires hooked up. In addition to pull station locations within 5 feet of each personnel exit, additional pull stations are required so that no location is more than 200 feet from one. This is usually interpreted as meaning that extremely long hallways will require a pull station every 400 feet. A doorway over 40 feet wide, such as in a mall or a concert hall, requires a pull station on each side. Sensors and supervision of sensors required sensor locations. The correct name is initiation devices, which we've been using up to this point, including pull stations, interface relays, smoke and heat detectors. Smoke detectors are inexpensive and reliable. They work anywhere within their temperature and humidity limits, where it is free of dust and vapors. Temperature limits are usually 32 to 100 degrees F and humidity less than 93%. They are not intended for attics or unheated storage spaces, also not for kitchens or locker rooms. If a design decision or external code requires smoke detectors, there is a choice of many, many types. One vendor seminar reported that a that particular vendor was ceasing to make anything except photoelectric smoke detectors. However, they couldn't find any application where the basic photoelectric detector wasn't the best choice. Other salespersons recommend other types of detectors. The code leaves the decision to the designer and approval by the authority having jurisdiction. The rule of thumb is to space smoke detectors or heat detectors on 30-foot centers. Stay away from walls. Try to get close to any high spots. Do not place the detector at the peak, which tends to be a dead space. There are a number of detailed rules in later paraphrasing of code sections. A detector must be installed over the fire alarm control panel. Heat detectors are slower than smoke detectors. They're not first choice except in locations with dust and vapors. Heat detectors are available in fixed temperature, rate of rise, combination, and analog. The combination fixed temperature rate of rise heat detector is arguably the best you can buy. Analog sensors report a numeric heat value to the fire alarm control panel and let the computer decide if fixed temperature rate of rise or fire signature rules have been met for an alarm. All alarm initiating circuits, that is heat, smoke, pull, and interface relays, must be supervised. Normally, this means that a small amount of electric current flows to an end-of-line resistor at all times. If the line is broken, that is open, current is reduced and a trouble light goes on. If the line is shorted or crossed, more current flows and a trouble light comes on. With digital addressable devices, the central panel computer can query each device every few minutes and verify that each is alive and well. The end-of-line resistor and current sensing are no longer required, but the system is still supervised. Smoke control. The 2007 fire alarm code is notably vague regarding smoke control. The hazards are clear: toxic fumes and obscured path of egress. The solution in previous editions of the code was a firefighter's smoke control panel called an FSCP. This was not defined, but generally interpreted to mean selector switches to permit the firefighter to selectively turn off and turn on individual fans and dampers to pressurize the space to retard fire spread or exhaust fumes and vapors to aid in evacuation. There are two very serious problems, however, as follows. First, the most basic fan control includes a duct smoke detector to disable the fan when smoke is present. A functional firefighter smoke control panel would have to be able to override the duct smoke detector. Second, considerable knowledge of the HVAC system, register locations, and the current fire status is necessary to use the selector switches wisely. The idea of the firefighter's smoke control panel remains in the 2007 code, but is loosely referenced to NFPA 101, which is not law, and all of the details of operation within 72 are optional. The NFPA meaning of smoke control is more than duct detectors, but it's not well defined in a regulatory sense at present. Duct smoke detectors. The goal of fire alarms is to save lives. Most deaths result from smoke inhalation, often toxic fumes released by the heat of the fire. It's critical to not distribute the smoke and toxic fumes from the fire throughout the building. For this reason, smoke detectors are installed on the return air duct of an HVAC system. The reasoning is that this is the point where the smoke from the occupied space will be present. The overriding goal is to shut down the fan. A secondary goal is to enunciate to the occupants that a problem exists and evacuation is called for. The HVAC codes require smoke detectors on the supply side of large handlers. Now, this is something for the HVAC designer to decide what's a large air handler, and he's supposed to know his HVAC codes, and he's supposed to tell you when it's got a smoke detector on the supply side. Certainly nothing wrong with asking him, are there any supply fans big enough to require a smoke detector on that side, but it's primarily his responsibility. The reasoning for a detector factor on the supply side is that the fan, motor, or belts may burn up, and the system will distribute these fumes to the occupied space. Some HVAC designers require smoke detectors on ductwork leading to exhaust fans. The fire alarm designer must provide an alarm initiation circuit and make sure the test reset control is provided. The reasoning behind smoke detectors on the exhaust is totally unfathomable. Specialized detectors such as beam detectors and UV sensors. It takes a lot of photoelectric smoke detectors to protect a warehouse. It may take 10 or fewer beam detectors. There's no drawback to the beam-type smoke detectors except cost and care required for installation. UV sensors also are very good detectors. Almost all commercial boilers use purple peepers to verify the flame. For boilers, the alarm takes place when the flickering is not detected. The same principle works well for well-defined fire hazards. Ultraviolet radiation is present in early stages of some fires. UV is not present in other fires, and smoke obscures the UV as it does visible light. With care, temperature and humidity limitations of photoelectric detectors can be avoided. An awkward topic will now be identified but not addressed. New technology. The 2007 Fire Alarm Code specifically accepts new unproven technology called performance-based systems. There is discussion of detectors sensitive to chemical vapors produced by specific fires and smoldering heaps. Your author has high confidence in primitive hardwired systems and addressable systems with smoke detectors, heat detectors, pull stations, and strobe horns. He is very slowly accommodating voice notification systems. New technology is reserved for other persons who have a high risk tolerance. CCTV, software smoke and flame detection. The 2007 Fire Alarm Code obliquely references UL-approved video image smoke detection and video image flame detection. With the current obsession on terrorist events, CCTV, closed-circuit television, cameras are being installed in massive numbers. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands. The concept of using these devices for fire warning has some attraction. The only UL-approved video image smoke detection system commercially available at the time of this course writing is Signifier, registered trademark, by Axonex, lower A, X-O-N, capital X, of Sparks, Maryland, known as Axon, AXONX.com. Selected texts from their literature and proposal are included below, followed by discussion. Now, if this is interesting to you, obviously go to their website and find out what they're saying about the product. I have quoted a couple paragraphs here to give a flavor of what's going on and perhaps to help you evaluate if you want to invest time in finding more about it. Axonex is pleased to provide the following proposal that will allow ABC Company to implement an advanced fire safety security solution to meet the requirements of its warehousing and data center facilities. Signifier trademark is a revolutionary technology that can detect fire and smoke over standard CCTV systems. In addition to providing advanced motion detection and all the other features standard of a digital video recorder, Signifier will allow all of your standard CCTV cameras to become early warning fire and smoke detectors. One benefit of this technology is its fast response when compared to standard point detectors such as spot-type smoke alarms or heat detectors. In addition, the early warning is combined with visual verification that allows security personnel to look at the live situation to determine the best course of action. Installing the Signifier system will increase situational awareness, reduce false alarms, better protect property and assets, and provide a safer working environment. Their emphasis. No, you know I was trying to be a radio announcer. After that, I've quoted the list that was on this pro forma quotation. It's a Signifier FSM8 camera system. By the way, to find this on the internet, you say Signifier. Nobody else uses the word Signifier because that's their trademark. Or you say FSM8, and you'll find some very strange things that are also FSM8s, but most of the hits will be this camera system. The quotation includes, and it has a price each and a total extension, one Signifier FSM8 DVR, capable of monitoring 8 analog cameras. Cost each $16,000. Total cost $16,000. 8 analog cameras FM approved. $400 each, $3,200 total. Security officer workstation front end Spider Guard trademark license, $2,000. System commissioning / installation plus travel and per diem expenses included. And that's actually, they had a total and it was something like $22,000. 4 points should be noted. Now we're turning to my commentary on their proposal. And this is a pro forma proposal that was validated for 30 days at the time the course was written. It's certainly not valid for you to go out and buy their system today for the $22,000. But it had significance the day the course was written. 4 points now might be noted. First, this is a Windows registered trademark, XP registered trademark, personal computer with an 8-camera video capture card. Video processing is very compute intensive. There are a lot of things you could say about this, and I decided I don't really want to be sued, so I'm not going to say any of these things. Let me just repeat, and you can reach your own conclusions. This is a Windows XP personal computer with an 8-camera video capture card. Video processing is very compute intensive. And maybe you want to decide if you want to put a life safety system on a Windows XP personal computer. When they say there's an 8-camera video capture card and it's very compute intensive, that strongly implies you don't put a second card in that personal computer. You've already bogged down the processor, so it's running as hard as it knows how. It's not going to pick up another 8 cameras. Second comment, mounting, power, cabling, and such are not part of what they call installation above. There is a footnote on this that you buy it through a local contractor that does the power, cabling, and mounting. Third, this is an initiation device. Do not be confused. This is not a fire alarm system for $22,000. This is an initiation device. Fourth, as best I could read the literature, it is approved by Factory Mutual, not Underwriters Laboratory. Factory Mutual specializes in property protection, where UL specializes in personnel protection. Notification devices and supervision. Required notification device locations. For many years, it was a fire bell. Typically, a pull station closed a switch, and electricity was fed to bells in the hallways. And it worked. And it still works, but it's not compliant with the current codes represented by the fire alarm code. Fire alarm code does not specify what type of notification device must be used. Bells, horns, speakers, strobes, and beacons all work well. The strobe horn combination is exceedingly economic and was the notification device of choice until recently. Some jurisdictions and state funding commissions are requiring voice notification. It's also required in high-rise apartments, condominiums, and some commercial buildings. Strobe speaker combination is now replacing the strobe horn. An advantage is the speaker requires less current for the same alarm loudness, so smaller wire can be used, and there's no cost penalty associated with the new technology. Notification circuits must be supervised, the same as initiation circuits. Notification devices, strobe horns and such, must be located within 15 feet of the end of each corridor, and not more than 100 feet apart within a corridor. When two or more strobes are visible from a location, they must be synchronized so that they flash together. The current rule of thumb for strobe horn locations is at least one in every public space, as lobbies, meeting rooms, workrooms, classrooms, laboratories, storerooms, factory area, or large restroom. For large spaces, one standard strobe horn, that's 70 dBA, 115 candela, is needed for each 400 square foot of floor space, or 27 square feet per candela. And this might find like a sound like a funny way to state it, but that's the way the code does it, so we should do it by the code. If you think 400 square feet, you've got the idea right. And that's a 20 by 20 space. So it's going to take a lot of strobes in a large banquet hall. We're out of time allocated for tape 5 of this session. I'm ready to take a break. I'll join you again in a few minutes, and we'll talk about hidden notification devices, which to me is a wonderful innovation, unfortunately with some drawbacks. Please join me then.